You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you. 1935, the American Automobile Manufacturers Association, also known as the Automobile Manufacturers Association. It was a lobbying group, a front group for the car manufacturers that ironically brought us Mitt Romney. They penned the phrase right to work for the very first time, 1935. Now, this is very similar. And by the way, I want to give credit where credit's due. Mark Ames, the labor desk over at NSFWCorp.com, just has written this absolutely brilliant piece. You hate right to work laws more than you know. Here's why. And it's a goldmine of factoids and data, and it's brilliantly written. Highly recommend it to you. And he points out in here, and I've run across some of this stuff in other places, but this, he pulled all of it together so well. First of all, what does this have to do with Mitt Romney? Romney's dad, George, was the governor of the state that I was growing up in, Michigan, when I was a kid, and he got there from being the president of AMC. American Motors Corporation. He got to be the president of the American Motors Corporation because he'd been the head lobbyist for the Automobile Manufacturers Association starting in 1939. But 4 years earlier, the AMA, the Automobile Manufacturers Association, had published they were trying to take down the Wagner Act. This was FDR's legislation that established the right of workers to form a union. And once they had formed that union by majority vote, a democratic institution, much like, you know, when states joined the union, you had to have a majority vote, these kind of things. And once they had created that union, then everybody who was benefiting from the work of that union had to pay dues to the union. It just makes sense. It's like, you know, if you join the Chamber of Commerce, they are, and you expect the benefits of joining the Chamber of Commerce. And there are many to big companies and small companies, too, even local companies. You damn well better pay your dues or they're going to kick you out. Same thing. Okay. So this really goes back, if you take this back in history, back in American history. The guy who was really behind all this, according to Mark Ames, is a fellow by the name of Vance Muse, M-U-S-E. And in talking about the Wagner Act of 1935, the law that established the right to unionize in the United States, and keep in mind, before the Wagner Act, unionization in the United States was in single digits, very, very few. And by 1947, it was 35% of American workers. We were, by the way, behind most of Europe on this. I mean, way behind. But Vance Muse wrote, this founder of the Right to Work anti-labor campaigns, in response to the Wagner Act, and this was the real core of this thing, was this racist rant. The original Right to Work laws were in large part, you know, just there was a racist genesis to these things. And he wrote, from now on, white women and white men will be forced into organizations with black African apes whom they will have to call brother or lose their jobs. That was the response. Basically, this coalition of fringe Southerners. Vance Muse was this guy from Texas who engineered basically a racist takeover, or, you know, within the Democratic Party that ultimately flipped the Democratic Party Republican. It was the original Southern strategy down in the South. And you look at this, I mean, you know, keep in mind, it wasn't until 1938 that child labor was outlawed in the United States. The Supreme Court had been fighting that. We passed child labor laws back in the 19-teens, and the Supreme Court knocked them down, said they're a violation of the right to contract. So, again, we were behind the rest of the civilized world. But, you know, go back to 1913. The Rockefeller family owned some mines in Colorado, the Ludlow Mines. And there was just it was an absolute massacre there. There was another one, this in West Virginia. Oh, I'm sorry, this was in Colorado. As Mark Ames writes, but you probably don't know many of the details, like how Rockefeller's private armed goons patrolled the miners' miserable tent cities in an armored car with a mounted machine gun, spraying the tents and terrorizing the strikers, who demanded radical concessions from the company, such as, quote, enforcement of Colorado's laws, end quote. Yes, this is what the workers wanted. They wanted an eight-hour work day. They wanted pay for the time that they actually worked. Eventually, there was this tent city, and they were being sprayed with bullets periodically by the goons who had been hired by the Rockefeller family. So they dug trenches inside the tent so that they could get below the bullets. That this was the miners and their families, their wives and kids. So when they dug those trenches and looked like they were going to be in for the long haul, the Colorado National Guardsmen poured kerosene on the tent, set it on fire, and killed people as they came running out. We know that at least a dozen children were killed, and multiple tens of workers, scores of workers and their wives killed, and hundreds of miners ultimately were arrested for the crime of being on strike. Seriously, that's what it was like in America before 1935. In fact, there was a Senate hearing on this, the La Follette hearing, the La Follette Senate Committee hearings, the Senate Committee report. And this is, Republic Steel, for example, is another one of these companies that operated a private army to kill, literally to kill, union workers or workers who were trying to unionize. And this is from the Senate, the official on-the-record Senate report. The Republic Steel Corporation, responsible for the 1937 massacre, this is another massacre, this is 1937, the company thugs and cops killed 10 peaceful marchers, nearly all of whom were shot in the back. It's a matter of public record. This is not some, you know, story about some union thug trying to take somebody off a ventilator. This is the public record. Quote, this is from the Senate, United States Senate report. Quote, Republic Steel Corporation, responsible for the 1937 massacre, has a uniformed police force of nearly 400 men whom it has equipped not only with revolvers, rifles, and shotguns, but also with mortar and sickening gas and gas equipment than has been purchased by any law enforcement body, local, state, or federal in the entire country. It has loosed its guards, thus armed, to shoot down citizens on the streets and highways. End of quote. This is what the Koch brothers want to take us back to. This is what the people who this is laissez-faire capitalism. What I'm describing to you is what you will find in those countries where there are no unions. It's what you would have found in the United States before your great grandfather or whatever knew before 1935 here in the United States, is that these were the conditions. And in 1935, the Wagner Act was passed, and allowing people to form unions, giving a legal protection, saying to the companies, sorry, you can't kill these people anymore for forming unions. You can't beat them up. You can't burn their houses down. You can't do any of those things. You can't even fire them unless they've actually not performed their work. We can't have that, said the Koch brothers of the day.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
It is absolutely astounding, the history of this. And that is where the phrase right to work came from the PR efforts of the American Automobile Manufacturers Association. This portion of the Tom Hartman Program is underwritten in part by Stamps.com, 1-800-Flowers.com, Carbonite.com, and EdisonFactor.com.
Oh, Did you hear that?
Okay, so this fellow by the name of Stetson Kennedy was a writer who in the 1940s went undercover with the KKK to write an expose piece. And writing about Vance Muse, the guy who came up with this whole right-to-work thing, the phrase. I mean, the meme on this thing is brilliant. It's like, you know, up until the 1970s, up until 1973 or 74, the phrase right to life, which has a wonderful ring to it, was the organizing phrase of the anti-death penalty movement in the United States. And the anti-abortion movement was called the anti-abortion movement, and it wasn't very significant. And then came Roe v. Wade, and the anti-abortion movement got much larger, and they said, we got to rename ourselves, and they renamed themselves Right to Life, and that, you know, thus it has been. And that's smart branding. Who would be opposed to the right to life? Similarly, who'd be opposed to the right to work? I mean, I want to work. You want to work. Everybody wants to work, right? I mean, there might be a few people who don't want to, but pretty much most everybody would like to have a decent job, good pay, and work that's fulfilling and fun or interesting. So this Vance Muse guy, Stetson Kennedy writes of him, the man Muse is quite a character. Again, this research done by Mark Ames of the Labor Desk over at nsfwcorp.com. This man Muse is quite a character. He's 6'4", wears a 10-gallon hat, but generally reserves his cowboy boots for trips north. Now over 50, this was published in 1946, by the way, Mark Ames notes, Muse has been professionally engaged in reactionary enterprises for more than a quarter century. And here's what he was doing. Excuse me. pardon me. He lobbied against women's suffrage. He was lobbying against women having the right to vote, which had just happened in the previous decade. He was arguing, he was lobbying against the Child Labor Amendment, which, again, keep in mind, the child labor laws in the United States did not take effect until 1938. He was laboring against, or he was lobbying against the 8-hour workday. And in 1936, as I mentioned in the last segment, he put together the first split in the Democratic Party. Yeah, called this in the South Democratic Party. But here's where it gets really, really interesting. Much of this I actually can't even read on the air because it's so full of the N-word. Skip past that. This, hang on just a minute here. This, again, Dixon writing about this. What he did in 1936 is Vance Muse created this thing called the Christian American Association. And in 1941, in an editorial in the Dallas Morning News, Vance Muse was, you know, writing and setting up this association. So Dixon writes, after traveling to Dallas and consulting with the editor, Muse was encouraged to use and promote the idea of right to work. This became the Christian American Association. Christian American Association was basically the KKK. They were dressing up the KKK. The KKK had historically been anti-union. It's to this day. This became Christian America's primary cause, and they campaigned extensively for right-to-work legislation throughout the country, and especially in Texas. There was a big business outfit, Mark Ames notes, called the Fight for Free Enterprise. And these guys would show up, of course, financed by the billionaires of the day. I mean, there were millionaires back then, but you know, the equivalent of the Koch brother kind of billionaires. They would show up and picket any striking workers. In other words, counter-picket. And they were promoting what used to be called open shop, which is the so-called right to work laws, which said that, you know, if you want to be a member of if you want to go to work in a company where more than half of the workers have decided that it should be a union shop, you get the benefits of the union. You get the benefits of the union contract. You can by law force the union's lawyers to represent you, the union representatives to represent you, the union to do things for you, but you don't have to pay dues into the union. So you can generate lots and lots of expenses for the union. You don't have to pay a penny. You can sabotage the union. It's really how these this whole right to work thing is organized. Is this what they do? Is they allow saboteurs, and it only really takes one or two inside a company to start stirring up against the union and saying, okay, you didn't defend me, or you didn't do this or that, and I'm going to sue you, and pretty soon it just gets very, very expensive for the union. Pretty soon the union's dead. And the so-called right to work for less, or right to work for less money, as the president called them, these laws make that possible. Vance Muse, during World War II, he was traveling around with his anti-labor signs, and he said it would keep the color line drawn in our social affairs. In 1944, he told the Houston Post that the Eleanor Clubs, this is these groups organized by Eleanor Roosevelt to help promote social welfare in the United States. She said that the First Lady was a red radical, and this was a scheme to organize Negro maids, cooks, and nurses in order to have a communist informer in every Southern home. End of quote. Keep in mind, this is 1944. And Muse's sister and partner in Christian America, Ida Darden, Mark Ames writes, told the Antioch Review, and this is a quote from the Antioch Review, that the Eleanor Club stood for a $15 a week salary for all N-word house help, Sundays off, no washing and no cleaning upstairs. It gets really, and then they went off on anti-Semitic rants, anti-worker rants. I mean, there is a hard right and bizarre foundation to this whole so-called right to work. It's not a movement. It's a paid-off thing.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
And the billionaires and the corporations behind it. After the break, my thoughts, your thoughts, and more of the news of the day. Okay, I just have to share with you. Now, I mean, you've noticed how extreme the modern day Republican Party has gotten. Dwight D. Eisenhower, in 1954, in a letter to his brother Edgar, said that should any political party ever advocate the destruction of labor laws, I'm paraphrasing from memory here, but you can easily Google this, look it up, or DuckDuckGo it, and look it up. He said, should any political party ever push to take down the labor laws, you would never see that political party again. He said, I know that there's a few millionaires down in Texas, the H.L. Hunt and others, who think that this is possible, but their number is small, and they are stupid. Look it up, Dwight Eisenhower. That was the old Republican Party. Dwight Eisenhower was a fan of organized labor. In fact, look up the 1956 Republican Party's, you know, I did a whole rant on this a week and a half ago. I'm not going to repeat it. But the 1956 Republican Party's party platform, bragged about how many more people were in unions as a result of the first 4 years of the Eisenhower administration, from 52 to 56, when he was running for re-election in 56. How the Republican Party stood with organized labor. So, you know, last night on our TV show, I interviewed Bruce Bartlett. Bruce Bartlett, in 1976, he started out, well, actually, his career goes beyond, before that, but he worked for Ron Paul. He worked for Jack Kemp. He wrote a book in 1981 called Reaganomics, Supply Side Economics in Action. He co-edited the book Supply Side Solution. He was, he was in the George Herbert Walker Bush administration, a senior policy analyst, the White House Office of Policy Development. Left that to become Deputy Assistant Secretary for Economic Policy at the Treasury Department. He worked at the Cato Institute. He's written in the New York Times, the Wall Street Journal, the Los Angeles Times, Fortune Magazine, Commentary Magazine. I'm saying all this because I want those of you who think of yourselves as Republicans, conservatives, or even independents to know that the guy who I'm going to play some clips of in just a second is not a Democrat. He's a Republican to this day. He was literally one of the inventors of supply-side economics. He was there in the Reagan administration. He has been writing for years and years and years for conservative publications, Bruce Bartlett. And here is what he had to say last night about, well, the Republican Party, clip number two.
They're all either crazy or stupid. I mean, it's the things have changed so dramatically since the days when I first got involved with the Republican politics, when the Republican Party was the party of ideas, and now it's the party of crazy people, ignorant Tea Party people, people who know nothing and are proud of it.
I'm sitting across the table from him, and this is what came out. And it was like, oh, okay. And what about economic policy? This is what he had to say about that.
The Republican Party, through Reagan and the first President Bush, didn't want to abolish the welfare state. They wanted to make it run properly. And they also believed that if you were going to spend money, you had to raise the taxes to pay for it. Now, they wanted to cut spending if possible. They wanted to get rid of waste, fraud, and abuse, etc. But at the end of the day, they felt the government needed to pay its bills. And now what has happened is they've said deficits don't matter. All we want to do is starve the beast and cut taxes. We don't really give a damn about spending. And that is really what has let the genie out of the bottle. So these crazy Republicans have actually created the foundation for the very deficits that they claim that they are opposed to.
This is a man mourning the loss of his own party. Bruce Bartlett was a member of my dad's Republican Party, which pretty much no longer exists. Greg in Lockport, Illinois. Hey, Greg, welcome to the program. Thanks for listening to WCPT. You wanted to talk about being a small business owner.
Yeah, I've been listening to your show for a long time, and I think society has kind of lost depth to their thinking. I mean, they don't want to take responsibility for anything that they do. There's definitely a loss of integrity. And I think what we have to do is think in more three-dimensional aspect of things. I mean, these arguments are being made like Boehner. I'm listening today to Ed Schultz, and he says that, you know, by putting taxes on big business, it's going to, you know, kill small businesses. But really it's not. What's killing small business is big business.
Yep.
I go to a supply house, and I have to pay more money for the material to do my job. They get the breaks in the first place.
Yeah. No, it's what we're looking at is monopoly capitalism, and you're absolutely right, and this is the destruction of small business in America. Greg, excellent point. Thanks for calling and making it. Beth in Mason, Michigan, you were at the protest day before yesterday.
I was, and one of the things that we're not hearing about is all the good things that happened that day. I arrived shortly after the people were moved off of Capitol Lawn out into Michigan Avenue and onto Capitol Avenue.
Mm-hmm.
And I walked a couple blocks. No one bothered me. I'm a small woman in my 50s. People were very nice when I got to the protest. I asked them things that were going on. I walked into the Capitol. The state police were very helpful. They did check my bag, but that's not uncommon. And I went into Senator Whitmer's office, talked with an aide for a few minutes, went outside, was cleaning up the Capitol lawn because the state had not provided any extra trash containers.
Hmm.
So some of us started picking up the trash off the lawn. The lady asked me if I'd had a chance to eat, that she'd share her sandwich with me. People were passing around pizza, bottles of water. You know, there were two negative incidents. And that seems to override all the good things that went on down there.
Yeah.
That people were celebrating. There was a gentleman who was celebrating his 96th birthday. He's a retired union member, and he was there, and it was his 96th birthday. The hospitality of the city of Lansing, the progressive organization that opened up their offices for warming stations, all of those different things that went on that were positive. The union provided buses from the union hall so that they didn't take up parking downtown. So there were a lot of good things that happened downtown.
Great. Beth, thank you for sharing that and putting it on the record. That's a marvelous story. And you're right. Fox has been doing this, If It Bleeds, It Leads journalism. And it's been about what I believe was a staged event anyway at the Americans for Prosperity tent. And this wannabe comedian, wannabe James O'Keefe guy, who apparently punked Hannity day before yesterday, and then yesterday, last night, Hannity had to have another guy come on and point out that this guy was provoking people. So anyhow, Beth, thank you for the call. Ed in Klamath Falls, Oregon. Hey, Ed.
Tom, I've been listening to you talk about the right to work for less laws now for a couple of days, and I can't help but think that attacking the states on a state-by-state basis is inefficient. Wouldn't it be easier just to change the federal law so unions no longer have to represent the non-union people in the shop? And
they already did that. They did that in 1947. It was called the Taft-Hartley Act, and what it did was it removed basically that part of the Wagner Act, the 1935 National Labor Relations Act, that said that if everybody votes for a union, then it is a union shop, and everybody who works in that shop is a member of the union and has to pay dues to the union and also gets benefits from the union. And the union is required by law to represent those people and to work on their behalf. And of course, in exchange for that, you pay dues. So it's already the case, Ed. Thanks for the call. Joe in Swarthmore, Pennsylvania. Hey, Joe, you're a Republican?
Yeah, I just wanted to say, I actually voted Republican for the past 10 years in a row.
Mm-hmm.
But I was the guy with the truck driver. I would start my day off with a Glenn Beck or a Rush and then a Sean Hannity. But it wasn't until the Tea Party came about that what actually ended up happening was I realized that they've gone so far to the right that I couldn't even be associated with them anymore. And I had a unique experience where I stopped listening to the right wing altogether for about a year. Because of my job, I just didn't listen to them.
Mm-hmm.
And then listened to them over the summer as a truck driver again. And you're right, you're saying your friend you had dinner with is right, that they've gone so far off the right-wing deep end that it's embarrassing to be associated with them.
Yeah. And this is what Bruce Bartlett was saying last night. I mean, he was saying that on our TV program. It wasn't over dinner. But yeah. And this guy, I mean, he worked in the Reagan White House. He knew Reagan. I mean, he knew George Herbert Walker Bush. He worked in the White House. He's still a Republican. And he's saying, Mike Purdy has gone nuts. Now, here's my challenge to you, Joe. If you call yourself a Republican and you think that the modern-day Republican Party is irrational, we need you. And by we, I mean America. The Republican Party needs you. The Republican Party needs good people to take it back to its Teddy Roosevelt progressive roots, or its Abraham Lincoln progressive roots. But to wake it up and turn it into a functional political party rather than simply the lapdog of the billionaire Koch brothers. So I would encourage you to show up at your local, in Pennsylvania, your local Republican Party meeting. Well, and stand for to become a a participant in the party, one of the representatives of the party, to become a precinct committee person.
It seems like the problem is that though, let's just say you show up to these parties, the party's been taken over by the loudest person in the room, essentially.
Well, yes and no. I think that we're entering a time where increasingly it's going to be the most rational person in the room, because I think that people inside the Republican Party are getting it that Limbaugh and the Koch brothers led them off a cliff, and the rest of them don't want to be lemmings. Joe, thank you for the call. I strongly encourage you. Please join the Republican Party.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
They need you. They really do. And, if they won't have you, then there's always the Democratic Party, the Green Party, the Libertarian Party. There's lots of options.
I'll show you just how cool scientists are. We study everything, that's why we're cool. And yes, most of us got high marks in school. And proud.
Indeed. Give me 2 minutes here. This is our geeky science moment where we're going to talk. I have to talk about science once a week or my head explodes. We are addicted to nuclear power, or at least the nuclear power industry is addicted to public welfare. We support it with Price Anderson. We support the nuclear industry with huge subsidies. The nuclear industry is killing, like, Japan, Chernobyl, Fukushima, so on. But most importantly, the nuclear industry is creating, and the nuclear weapons industry as well, has created this conundrum. We're creating nuclear waste that's going to be deadly to humans for a million years. And we're concentrating. We're putting it in stockpiles and stashing it in places. Now, humans have only been in our modern form for 165,000 years. We've only been agricultural for 10,000 years. We've only been in modern civilization, as it were, for about 6,000 years. So how can we warn people 200,000 years from now who might have been through several culture and civilization destroying events that this place in the ground has 1 million pounds of radioactive waste that for 1 million years will kill you if you get near it? It's like you can't carve it in stone. Stone, you know, withers away. Stone gets blown away. Stone gets etched by time and by sand and by water. You can't write it on paper. Obviously, paper rots. You can't put it in clay tablets like the Sumerians did. I mean, there's very few of those that made it through just the last 6,000 years. How do you tell people 200,000 years from now, 400,000 years from now, look out, this is a nuclear waste dump? Some scientists in France have come up with what they think is the answer. This is a serious problem that the nuclear industry is looking at, or that other people outside the nuclear, actually the nuclear industry I don't think gives a rat's patootie, but these French researchers, they said, let's take a 20-centimeter diameter disc made out of aluminum oxide. It's known as industrial sapphire. So this is 5 times stronger than tempered glass. It's almost as hard and as strong as a diamond. Let's take this industrial sapphire, etch onto it the information, do it in such small type that you can see it with a microscope. So you can put an enormous amount of information on a little square that's four inches by four inches. And the civilization would only have to be as advanced as we were in the 16th century, have microscopes, you know, Van Leeuwenhoek and all that stuff. Maybe it was the 17th century. And they could read it. And then into those etchings, you pour platinum, and then you, which doesn't rust like iron and isn't soft like gold, you put platinum, and then over the top of it, you put another layer of industrial sapphire so you can see it there. But it doesn't break, and nothing can take it apart. This is the solution that they're talking about. I think, you know, it's a great idea. I think also we should just stop nukes, right? No nukes. No more. So, anyhow. Surfer John in Ben Lomond, California. Hey, Surfer John, what's up? You got a union
story. Right on, Tom. It's good to talk to you. And thanks for validating many hours of arguments with the family with the movie Heist. They can't run from me anymore. So I want to tell you a great story. I was in the union, I thought, here in the 80s, in the early 90s. Reagan had just come through and destroyed the unions here in California. And I could see the effects in my community. But I had gone to work for a contractor who was a fierce anti-union guy. And all of a sudden, it was interesting because one day he came to me and said, hey, you got to be in the union to work on this job. You know, you can be in the union now and, you know, you'll have benefits and all these. I thought it was a great deal. So I joined the local 270 and went to work for this man crossing a picket line. I was a young guy. I didn't, you know, I was raised under Reagan to believe that, unions were some type of horrible people that wanted some of my money out of my paycheck, and I crossed these picket lines. I went to work, and lo and behold, when I got my first paycheck 2 weeks into this job, my boss, this guy who I realize now is a fierce anti-unionist, called me into his office and said, well, you're not a journey-level Mason. I can't pay you these wages. You don't think you're entitled to all this money, do you? I mean, that's just silly, right? And I was a young guy, and I wanted to be a company man and be a team player, and I cut this guy half my check every week.
Wow.
He sold for me. And this is the kind of thing that happens when we go around.
This is the kind of thing that happens when people don't organize together and represent themselves in a workplace.
I was fooled. You know, I want to say I was a young man. I thought I was pretty politically charged because I'd been in the punk rock movement when it was a political movement, when it was about tearing stuff down. Mm-hmm. And so I thought I had a clue. But I've since discovered democracy, Tom, and you helped me do that. And I'm really active in my community, and I want to thank you for that.
Good on you, John. Thank you very much for the call, and thanks for the great story. Ashes in Palatine, Illinois. Hey, Ashes.
Hello, Tom. Hi, how are you?
Great. What's on your mind? You wanted to talk about this so-called right to work for less law.
Yeah. I have a question. If these people who are in a union and they don't want to pay their dues,
mm-hmm.
And if more and more people don't pay their dues, eventually the union will go away, right?
So yes.
Don't these people know that if they don't pay their dues and the union goes away, then they won't have a union on their behalf negotiating for them. They won't get any benefits like that. So
right, but all it takes is one or two people inside the company who want to suck up to the boss or want to climb the ladder to say, you know, and you can only do this in a right to work for less state, who are going to be in a union shop, not pay their union dues, and then start doing things that require the union to engage in costly processes like legal defense of them. And then, they can bring down the union. They can break, just a couple of people in a right to work for less shop can break a union. It's not that difficult. Koch brothers know this, and that's why they're funding these anti-union efforts all around the country. And once a state has flipped from closed shop to open shop, which is what it used to be called, once they have flipped from free association to right to work for less, then they're screwed. I mean, you're right, Ash. And people need to wake up. They need to understand that. And it's not you and your union job. Most people in America don't have a union job, but it is you and your community where typically wages are established. In most communities in the United States, the floor of wages are set by union workers. That goes away, there goes your floor.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. 6 minutes past the hour in the second hour of our program. And one of the really genuinely good guys in the United States Senate, Senator Jeff Merkley, the Democrat from Oregon, on the line with us. Senator Merkley, welcome back.
Thank you so much. It's wonderful to be with you.
Thank you. I should know your website, merkley.senate.gov. I know that you only have 5 minutes. You've got to run, so I appreciate your dropping by the program. Two things, filibuster reform that you have been working on, and also the Medicare age thing. I'm curious your take on that, but let's start with filibuster reform.
Well, right now it's crucial for folks to get engaged because when we come in on January 3rd, we're going to have a big debate over the rules. And what we need to do is to say it's not acceptable to sit back and watch a progressive agenda be rolled over by these silent filibusters that the public can never see. And instead, we need to eliminate a number of the opportunities for obstruction. And when people do vote for additional debate, that they actually have to take to the floor of the debate, have a talking filibuster rather than a silent filibuster.
Back to Mr. Smith Goes to Washington.
Indeed, and it does a couple things. You have to spend time and energy, so you don't do it on trivial things the way it happens on every single motion now. Mm-hmm. A contrast here is that Johnson in 6 years faced a single filibuster, and Harry Reid has faced almost 400 filibusters. And you just see how that devastates the ability of the Senate to address business.
Right. And that business is very often the real needs of the American people. And Senator Merkley, you've been talking about the eligibility age for Medicare. Your thoughts on that?
Yeah, absolutely. There has been a notion floating around that it's a good idea to raise the age from 65 to 67 or even higher. And I can tell you that those of us who go out and talk to our citizens across this country, I do a lot of town halls. I've done over 140 of them in 4 years. People come up to you and they say, you know, here's the challenge I'm facing. I don't have insurance on the job. I have these deteriorating conditions, and I'm just trying to stay alive until I can get real medical care at age 65. And if we start talking about raising the age, really what we're saying is that seniors will have no good options because it'll be too expensive for them to buy private insurance at that point in their life, and Medicare will be out of reach. And I think we should be talking about lowering the age, and which we actually did talk about during the Affordable Care Act, but we didn't get it done. Yeah. But we certainly shouldn't be raising it.
Yeah, we could lower the age to birth and call it Medicare Part E.
For
everyone. Huh? But, you know, I've often suggested that Social Security and Medicare, Social Security retirement age and the Medicare eligibility age, if you were to drop both of them by 5 to 10 years so that people could retire at 55 or at 60, there would be a small percentage, or maybe even half, I don't know, but a percentage of people of that age would take that retirement, even if it was a more minimal retirement. And what that would do is it would suddenly tighten up the labor market, which would raise wages.
More job opportunities.
Yeah, it would create all kinds of job opportunities for young people.
Yeah.
So anyhow, that's my pitch. So, but I know you've got a boogie, and we had just 5 minutes with you, and I think we burned through it. Is there anything else on your mind that you wanted to share with our listeners?
Oh, there's so much. There is so much. But let me just say, right now I'm so focused on the filibuster. If your folks can visit fixthefilibuster.com, it'd be great. Call your senator. Tell them that this obstruction of an agenda, a people's agenda, by the silent filibuster is unacceptable. We've got to have a talking filibuster replace it.
Fixthefilibuster.com. And one L in filibuster, right?
Yes, indeed.
There we go. Okay. Senator Jeff Merkley, thank you so much for being with us.
You're welcome.
It's much appreciated. And keep up the great work, sir. You're doing a marvelous job. Whew. Boy, there's so much going on. But this is a great meme. I got to share this with you. This is one of the greatest threads. I've noticed this for a couple of days, kind of trending over at Democratic Underground, and people at TomHartman.com pointed it out, and others. As I get older, I find myself becoming more conservative. Well, what does that mean? This is Bucky Rowling, and he says, "I'm 49. I may act like a kid most of the time. There's no denying that I'm officially middle aged now." High blood pressure, receding hairline. And even if I don't shout at him about it, I don't like it when those damn kids are on my lawn. And then he says, it's a metaphor, of course, the damn kids he's talking about are Fox News and the Republican Muppets. And by my lawn, he's talking about Medicare and Social Security. And he said, but he wants to conserve the environment. He wants to conserve the middle class. He wants to conserve the Bill of Rights. He wants to conserve Medicare. He wants to conserve Social Security. What's not conservative about that? He says, as a conservative, I steep myself in traditional American values, then constantly worry that we're losing touch with the things that made America great, like labor unions and the civil rights movement. Yeah. When America builds infrastructure, business flourishes. So do more of that, he says, I say. All right. Anyway, he goes on, the American work ethic and, you know, particularly conservative on taxes. No more free rides, I say. Right? Everyone should pay their fair share of tax. What's with this 15% tax rate that Mitt Romney has? How did he manage that? What kind of loophole is that? Capital gains, you say? Just for rich people, you say? This is the Paris Hilton tax cut, tax loophole? This is my addition to his rant. But anyhow, he says, like, get off the government welfare, Walmart. Yeah. GE and ExxonMobil and all these other giant, very profitable corporations. Enough already. So anyhow, we've been talking about the sordid history of the filibuster. Do you know that much of the Red Scare in the 1920s, 1930s was actually promoted by these KKK, an American Christian organization? What was the Vance Muses organization? It's called the Christian American Association. They used this, things like the Palmer Raids, they used these as ways to bust unions. Saying, oh, those union people, they're communists. They're associated with Moscow. And go after them and take them out. So, know from whence your history comes. Lewis in Eureka, California. Hey, Lewis, your dad worked for the Teamsters?
Yeah, he did, Tom. I had just a couple of quick points that I was hoping I could get out so your audience could hear.
Mm-hmm.
He drove, he was a Teamster truck driver for a major bakery. I'm not going to mention their name other than they made wonderful bread.
Okay.
And, you know, you had to be on the loading dock at 4 o'clock in the morning to get everybody bread out to the stores before they would open.
Right.
He did that for 30 years.
Wow.
He's recently I know this for a fact. He had a middle class income the whole 30 years that he worked there.
Yep.
I also know, because it was common knowledge there at the plant, that the owner, he had a driver. He had a limousine that brought him to work every day.
Mm-hmm.
He had a middle class income. My dad is now retired, but he keeps in touch with a lot of the drivers that still work there.
Mm-hmm.
And with these right to work laws that they're coming up with now,
mm-hmm.
The guys on the loading dock say they don't have a problem with it, because they got a big welcome basket ready for anybody that wants to come in.
What do you mean?
It's not going to be good, Tom.
Oh, yeah, the right to work.
You come in there and you're not Teamsters, they got a welcome basket ready for you.
Okay. Lewis, thank you for the call. Not sure what that means, but Bob in Marseille or Marcelles, Illinois. How do you say it? It's Marcelles, isn't it?
Marcelles, and Marcelles. It's because nobody in town can speak French.
Okay. Hey, Bob, let me put you on hold. I'm sorry I missed that cue that we're coming into a break. I'll pick you up on the other side of the break. We'll be right back when WCPT rejoins us in 4 minutes. It's 15 minutes past the hour here on the Tom Hartman Program. Where does the union movement go next? The Republicans have declared now New Jersey is next. Or at least they're seriously thinking about it. Is Chris Christie really going to do that?
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
On the one hand, it would immediately endear him to the Koch brothers. On the other hand, it would enrage the workers in the state. Really? Is it going to be?
Would you lock the door? Will you still need me?
Well, you are 65 or 67 or whatever the age may be. Peter Ferrara is on the line with us. He is a senior fellow with the Carlson Center for Public Policy, theccpp.org. And Peter, welcome back.
Glad to be here.
Okay. The GOP's real motives for cutting Social Security. In my opinion, the real reason the Republican Party and people like Pete Peterson, this Wall Street billionaire, have spent hundreds of millions of dollars, Pete Peterson just personally spent hundreds of millions of dollars, trying to get Social Security privatized, is that there's $2.7 trillion sitting in that trust fund, and they would love to get their hands on it.
Well, there's no actual money in the trust fund. This trust fund is just a statement of legal authority that the federal government has to draw from general revenues to pay Social Security benefits in the future, in addition to payroll tax revenues.
So you don't put any money into Treasury bonds or Treasury bills because you don't believe that that's real money?
Well, that's the federal government says that. The federal government repeatedly says that over and over. There's no money in that trust fund. You have to turn those bonds into the federal government. The federal government has to come up with the money in order to pay Social Security benefits based on those bonds.
Okay,
there's no money in the trust fund that can be used for anything.
So, I'm holding a $1 bill here in my hand, and it says Federal Reserve Note at the top. This is an obligation not of the United States government, but of the Federal Reserve. Does that mean that I don't have real money?
The Social Security trust funds do not hold those $1 bills.
Okay, so if I go out and I buy, a $1,000 Treasury bill, do I not have what I'm going to get is a piece of paper that says basically the federal government owes you $1,000, thank you for investing, and plus a little bit of interest. Do I not have something that's worth $1,000?
The Social Security Trust Fund does not go out and buy Treasury bonds or Treasury bills, so they don't. They don't go out and buy Treasury bonds.
Then why is the Social Security Trust Fund listed as part of the U.S. government's debt? Why is
because
it listed?
It's part of the gross federal debt. It's not part of the because it's a statement of the legal authority that Social Security has to draw from general revenues in the future. So it is part of the gross federal debt. So when there's a surplus in Social Security every year, what Social Security does with that surplus, there's no more surpluses, but when there were,
right.
They wouldn't take that and save it in the trust fund. And they wouldn't even go out and buy government bonds with the money. It'd be a far better deal if they had did that, but that's not what they do. They give that surplus to the federal government, and the federal government spends that surplus.
No, George Bush actually pulled those bonds out of a drawer and waved at him and said, look, they're just paper. just like they're slightly different, but very similar to the bonds that he was born with when he was born a millionaire.
They don't go out in the market and buy bonds. What they do is they buy them from the federal government. They give the surplus to the federal government. The federal government spends that money, so that money's gone. And they get back from the government a notation that says,
Social Security Administration is redeeming those bonds.
You want to know or not how it works?
I do know how it works.
Okay. No, you don't know how it works, and I'm explaining to you how it works. The government gives them back a note that says, when you need the money, you call us, and we'll give it back
to you. Yes, that note is called a treasury bill.
It's not a treasury bill. They send the money.
They're special ones for Social Security, but they're basically treasury bills. They're debts against the U.S. Treasury. Are you saying that if I'm a defense contractor and the federal government says, we want you to build an F-35, we're going to pay you $300 million, and I've got a contract that says I'm going to be paid $300 million, that because I haven't got that in stacks of $1 bills, that I don't actually have money from the federal government, and I'm not going to get money from the federal government?
Can you spend that?
I'll bet I could. I could probably borrow against it. I could go to
If you borrowed against it, you could spend it, but you can't spend it. Just like there's nothing to spend in the Social Security Trust Fund at all. In order to get the money that's in the Social Security Trust Fund, the federal government will have to raise taxes or borrow additional money.
Okay, let me get this, Peter. Let me see if I'm following this right. If I go to the bank and say, I want to buy a house, I want to buy this house for $500,000. Please give me $500,000. The bank writes a $500,000 check to me. I give that to the person who owns the house. The bank gives me a contract that says I owe the bank $500,000. When the bank comes to me and says, we want some money, I can say, I just have a contract. I don't have money here. I don't have any money to give you. This is just a contract that says I owe you money.
The bank can't spend the money you owe them until you pay them.
Right.
Just like the Social Security Trust Fund cannot spend the money they're owed until the federal government pays them.
So we can just all tell the banks to take a leap.
They have exactly $0.00 in that trust fund, and they cannot pay anything out of that until they raise taxes.
Then how are they paying right now?
What?
How are they paying right now? The trust fund is going down right now.
The incoming payroll tax revenues and all the benefits are paid out of those incoming payroll tax revenues. And because
not all of them, Peter. You know this. I mean, I know that you know this. That $2.7 trillion has become $2.6 trillion.
Because there's a deficit, now the Social Security Administration takes bonds for that deficit and sends it to the government and says, okay, we need to cash it in. But they can't spend it until the government goes out and gets it. The government doesn't have any money in the trust fund. The government has to raise it.
At a certain level, Peter, this argument is sort of like, a couple of Jesuits back in the 16th century arguing about how many angels will fit on the head of a pin. Let me ask the larger question here in the minute that we have left. And just,
there's no money in there.
Genuinely want to toss this to you. Why? What's your philosophical opposition to poverty insurance and disability insurance for all ages, which is what Social Security is?
I'm not opposed to I want higher benefits for working people, and the only forms I propose benefit cuts in Social Security. The only forms I support are forms that will increase benefits received by seniors rather than reduce them.
And privatizing Social Security would do that?
Yes, it would do that. Yes.
Handing this over to Wall Street?
Yeah, because you'd have savings and investment.
Because those guys at HSBC that just paid $1.7 billion in fines because they've been laundering money for narco-terrorists and for Middle Eastern terrorists, the guys who knocked down the 9/11 towers, that bank, we should give them our Social Security money. I'm wondering why we shouldn't drop a drone bomb on that bank.
A lifetime of savings and investment will always pay you more than a lifetime of no savings and investment, which is what Social Security is. It's your personal choice. If you think
it's insurance,
robbers, you just stay with the crooks and robbers that are in Washington.
It is insurance.
All the money out of Social Security Trust Fund, and spend it.
It is insurance.
They're more reliable. You just depend on them. I wish you would.
It is.
I hope you get that choice, and I hope you make the wrong choice.
Okay. Well, Peter, you're personalizing this a lot. I wish you the very best and happy holidays, Peter. Thanks for being with us. Good talking.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
That was, by the way, I should have said it at the end. Peter Ferrara, Senior Fellow at the Carlson Center for Public Policy, theccpp.org. 28 minutes left here. Oh, you're doing this to me, Shano. I got up this morning and I said to Louise, okay, you know what's stuck in my head? And she's what? I said, Adeste Fidelis in Latin. And I couldn't remember the second line in Latin. And so I was like Googling it to get the, And she's like, only you have music stuck in your head in Latin. And I finally got it out of my head about 10 o'clock this morning, and you play it as a bumper. Louise has been talking with you. Okay, Shano, thank you. HSBC, this is the third largest bank in the world. It started in Hong Kong over 100 years ago, and it's the sixth largest public company in the world. Now, let me just ask this kind of rhetorical question. What do we hear in the United States? What does our government do? What does the Obama administration do if there's some guy in Yemen who's plotting to do another 9/11? What do the terrorists, you know, what's up with the terrorists? Well, we drop drone bombs on them, of course. And what do we do if we catch them here in the United States? We put them in Gitmo. Yeah. Well, HSBC has been convicted of laundering money for those same terrorists and also for narco-terrorists down in Mexico. They are paying a $1.92 billion. $1,920 million. That doesn't make sense when you say it that way, but it's $1 million, 1,920 times. $1.92 billion in criminal fines. Criminal fines. Not one of these banksters is in Gitmo right now. And the HSBC headquarters in London is not a smoldering pile of rubble. I wouldn't have done that. It is not. And you know, I don't think it should be. I'm not calling for that. I'm just saying, why is it that, you know, we take out terrorists this way, but for that matter, you know, if you go to your local, and this is, you know, many people in America have been busted for this, going to, you know, wiring money back to Pakistan or back to, and it ends up in the hands of Al-Qaeda, and these people go to jail. I mean, there was this whole hunt for people like this. We have lots and lots of people in the United States in jail right now for support of terrorism. Nobody from HSBC. Anyhow. Laura in Dearborn, Michigan, listening to WDTW. Hey, Laura, what's up?
Hi. I wanted to comment about how peaceful I felt that the demonstration with the 15,000 people plus in Lansing, Michigan was yesterday. I'm 58 years old. And my sister and I were there to support the unions. And while we were there, we were approached by someone who had asked us if we would go over and be a buffer between the police line and the union activists that were getting a little rowdy. And they said, if you do that, that will keep the police won't mow down on grandmothers, and neither will the union guys. So we went over there and calmed down a little bit of a situation, said, hey, guys, these guys are just here. We don't have a beef with these police. We've got a beef with the Capitol. And yeah, we stood in the line. And
the cops are union members, by the way.
Pardon me?
The police are unionized.
Oh, well, you know, we know that. But there had been just a little bit of a, I guess, and I hadn't seen it, but I'd heard there had been a little bit of a skirmish where somebody threw some water on a policeman. And,
oh, no.
But, yeah. But you know, that was...
Well, good on you, Laura, for trying to de-escalate the situation. And thanks for calling and sharing the story. I beg your pardon? The water thing was faked? No? Louise says, okay, all right. Laura, thank you very much for the call. Appreciate it. Paul in Lucerne, California. Hey, Paul, what's up?
Hey, Tom, I was going to comment on unions and how they actually help people.
Mm-hmm.
I used to work construction in Sacramento, all right? And if you worked on a prevailing wage job, you made way more money. An average laborer in Sacramento would make between $7 and $10 an hour. Mm-hmm. But if you worked for a prevailing wage job, like a government job, if you were building a school, a contractor was building a school or working for the government, he had to pay you a prevailing wage.
Right.
And the prevailing wage for a laborer at that time was $25.05 an hour.
Yeah, it was the union wage.
Yeah, basically. That was the union wage. That's what
and that's an example. That's an example of how unions set the floor for wages, even for non-union employees. Yeah.
Exactly. And Sacramento was not a union town like the Bay Area is.
Yep.
All right. So the workers did not make nearly as construction did not make nearly as much. But when you work for a government agency, you did, and there was a lot of government in Sacramento.
Yeah, there's the name for that law is one of these hyphenated two-name names, you know, and yeah.
I don't know what it is, but all I know is whenever you work for a government agency as a through a private contractor, they have to pay you a prevailing wage.
You're absolutely right, Paul. And that's a great example. Thank you for the call. That's a great example of how they do establish a floor. Alyssa, in South Coffreyville, Oklahoma, you wanted to comment on Peter Ferrara's suggestion that all of our Social Security insurance programs should be given over to people like HSBC, the third largest bank in the world, that is laundering money for terrorists.
I can't. I'm on disability for severe depression. I'm not even making it anymore on Social Security. And I was an LPN. And where I worked at a nursing home, they were talking union, but it was only for the nurse aides and housekeeping, et cetera. A nurse couldn't join it. No, I'm very pro-union.
Okay. Alyssa, thank you very much for calling and for sharing that with us. I appreciate it. Bill in Oak Forest, Illinois. Hey, Bill, where do you think the labor movement goes from here?
Well, I'm here in, as you said, Oak Forest, Illinois, and I believe there's somewhere around 900,000 unionized workers in the state of Illinois. If there's a state where I think labor, and not just union labor, but all of labor, can make a stand and start moving this thing forward, it's here in Illinois. We need to show the ability to mass mobilize, come out with a very aggressive agenda of our own, and push that in every library and every neighborhood that we can find. But I think we need to really have a day of mass action, not with 15,000 people. I see no reason why labor can't turn out a couple hundred thousand people.
And here's where the focus of the attention should be, Bill, in my humble opinion, is that we should be doing what Dwight Eisenhower wanted to do in the 1950s. But, you know, there was such a boom during the 50s from his interstate highway construction projects and building hospitals and schools and everything that he was doing that you know, nobody thought really that union labor was under assault. And so, but we should be rolling back the Taft-Hartley Act. Made it possible for states to say that they're going to take an exemption from the Wagner Act. They're not going to follow the federal rules for unions, at least in all regards. And the Taft-Hartley Act, you know, was a moment of Republican insanity in the 1947 Congress, and it really needs to be repealed, because without that act, this whole right to work for less stuff would not be possible, and we'd go back to the default under the Wagner Act, and we'd go back to unionizing this country. So, or people should be pulling together and saying we want card check. But see, even card check, you get the union in, and again, you get some free riders, some freeloaders, whatever you call them, and particularly who are trying to suck up to management or even being paid by management to work there, and then they're going to go ahead and bust the union from within. It could be really, really destructive. We need to roll back Taft-Hartley. Bill, thank you for the call. It's a great suggestion. Doug in Seattle, you're a union member of 33 years?
Yes, I was. I wanted to use the union that I was affiliated with for a long time as an example about how we can kill the union to save the union.
Okay.
Okay, the way unions usually work is your officers are, in this case it's a bus drivers union, they are elected, and they become union presidents, vice president, right. Financial secretary.
Because unions are democracies.
Yes. And what happens is when we do things and go to negotiate or we go into arbitrations, or, you know, do contract things, third-step grievances. Those are all done usually by these guys with the help of attorneys. So what my idea is, and to get rid of the freeloaders, is to have a couple of attorneys, a law firm for ourselves within, that we don't pay union dues, we pay into a pool and become clients of a law firm that takes the place of the officers and the executive board, and they represent us at the higher levels. Most of the work, 75% of the work, is done for free by shop stewards.
Right.
They could become mentors in the workplace. Stop using the union phrases, but still do the union functions. Yeah. And
the problem here, Doug, is that the law requires unions to represent you if it's a union shop. And in a right to work for less state, you don't have to pay the union dues for that representation. And are you suggesting that by saying I'm not paying that the union, instead of asking for dues, they're going to ask for a legal fee. I don't see the legal mechanism by which they could collect that legal fee.
Well, the way it would work was basically unions, a big part of it is to protect seniority and to represent you when you're in trouble. And usually it's 5% of the workforce that causes 95% of the problems for the union. And they, like you say, they cause a lot of mayhem, cost the unions a lot of money.
Right.
Just do away with the actual official designation as a union local. And instead, each person becomes a client of a law firm that performs.
So each individual person would have to sign a contract with that law firm. And that's where it's going to get
sticky. In other words, you have a relationship between a law firm. You have a legal relationship between the law firm and the represents you and yourself.
I got the suggestion. It's a thought. Doug, thank you very much for the call. And we'll be right back. 45 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
So what do we do with economic terrorists, you know, like banks that support terrorism?
Ain't that good news? Man, ain't that news? Ain't that news? Ain't that good news? Man,
back. Let's check the news with the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com, and Ellen Ratner with the Talk Radio News Service, brought to you, by the way, by goatsfortheoldgoat.com. You can give a crystal heart made by women recovering from the effects of war in South Sudan by going to goatsfortheoldgoat.com. Ellen.
I don't have a lot of the details, but number one is that we are expecting the speaker. I'm here at the White House right now. You can see Jeff in back of me. We are expecting the speaker to be here in 10 minutes for a meeting with President Obama. Now, there's a lot of speculation as to whether that means, is there some kind of deal? Are they getting closer? My guess is yes, because otherwise the speaker would not be making his way over here.
That's interesting. So you're thinking that even with the current composition of the House of Representatives and all these Tea Partiers who are going to lose their jobs in a couple of weeks, who historically have resisted doing anything that is collaborative with the president, that there may, you know, there
even
may be a deal.
If he got half of his, if he got half of his folks, the Republicans, and they get pretty much all the Democrats because the president brings them along, then they're done. They don't need the wacko Tea Party people.
Yeah. Well, if anything happens, would you please let us know? Would you call us back and tell us?
Oh, I will. I will.
Okay, great. Now, I understand also there's breaking Susan Rice news.
I don't think they announce anything. I really don't.
Yeah. Okay. I understand there's also breaking Susan Rice news.
Yes, there is breaking Susan Rice news. So she has decided to withdraw her name, although it was never formally put in. She said that going through all of this was somehow going to really be destructive pattern, going through the confirmation hearings, et cetera. Obviously, she was asked to make a statement by the White House. She didn't come to this on her own. And obviously, they have decided that it's really way too much for her to do this. And frankly, she, as you know, although I didn't think Benghazi had a darn thing to do with whether she should be there or not, I just thought she was not a good choice because of her Africa policies, because of her drone policies. And there is rumor on the circuit that Hillary Clinton does not really like her that much.
Oh, that's interesting. Okay, I mean, so does that mean that John... Does that mean that John Kerry is going to leave the Senate, or are there other serious contenders?
Well, again, they have to decide on the John Kerry issue. If I was the political director at the White House, one of the things I would be taking a look at is where does that seat go in Massachusetts? And A, can they afford to lose it? And B, who would they put up in Massachusetts to go against Scott Brown? Because it's very clear, you know, he is a senator until the first of the year, and he will run again. There's no question that the Republicans are going to run Scott Brown again.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay.
So, so they have to really do that kind of math. One, could they afford to lose the seat? Two, you know, and it's interesting, when I mentioned this to some Republicans, they say, oh, Scott Brown, he's really a Democrat in Republican clothing. No, he's not.
Right. Yeah. No, he's a Republican who kept trying to pretend he was a Democrat when he was up for re-election.
Right. Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. Okay. There's some other things going on. Well, one other thing. There isn't a whole lot else going on. But there is the Sandy supplemental. Bill Pascrell of New Jersey, he's a Democrat, and he said that the FEMA funding for Hurricane Sandy is set to run out in February. And he then put forward the bipartisan Hurricane Sandy tax relief, and it would move from the supplemental appropriations bill that President Obama requested and use a similar kind of legislation that they used in Hurricane Katrina. The bill focuses on individual business housing assistance, as well as Hurricane Sandy bonds, which would give $9.2 billion to New York City and New Jersey, $3.2 billion to Connecticut to put towards new state-by-state private activity bonds earmarks. This is having to do rebuilding. As I think I've told you once before, that also what they did is they used a lot of this money in Mississippi and around the Gulf Coast after Hurricane Katrina to help people to actually learn to do carpentry and other kinds of jobs. And so that is actually where they used some of that money. And people actually not only learned it, they were hired to do these jobs, and it really brought back the economy back in the area.
Right. It's all about demand. And if you can put money in working people's pockets, or even money in people who aren't in the pockets of people who aren't working, they will start buying things, which will create a demand for people to work, and suddenly there'll be jobs.
Exactly.
It's kind of
and one other thing that actually happened 2 days ago that I did not mention to you, and that is that Secretary General Ban Ki-moon actually made a statement on homophobia. Mm-hmm. And it's really quite surprising because so many of his member states are terribly homophobic, you know, where they have a death sentence or years in prison. I mean, you cannot even go to Trinidad and Tobago, which I've often gone to and didn't realize this, and get a visa to be there if you're homosexual. Hmm. They don't ask you, but obviously that they don't even want a gay person there. It's okay that they have a lot of drug runners there, but if you're gay, you're not allowed in Trinidad and Tobago.
Well, that's kind of sad. That's
so the Secretary General has been very, very active on that.
Good, good. Bruce Bartlett last night told me that the former advisor to Presidents Reagan and Bush and longtime Republican, told me that he thought that the Republican Party is now crazy, stupid, and proud of it. How is John Boehner going to deal with these folks?
Well, he doesn't need to deal with them for this. As Speaker, is he going to have to deal with them? Yes, except that a lot of those Tea Party people went away. There are more Democrats. And what he has to do is figure out, is there any way that this can be that they can take this party and formulate an election winning strategy. Mm-hmm. I don't know.
It seems to me like, you know, there was that Todd Akin moment around rape and abortion, and I hope that, you know, what happened in Michigan this week is a Todd Akin moment around labor, you know, where Americans and Michiganders go, really? That's really what they're all about. We will see. Ellen Ratner with the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com, brought to you by goatsfortheoldgoat.com. Thank you, Ellen.
Thank you.
Have a great afternoon, and give us a shout if anything breaks there at the White House. We will be back right after this with more of the news of the day, your thoughts, my thoughts. Oh, I've got to tell you about what's going on with the victims of Hurricane Sandy.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. Listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And just a couple of quick points. Susan Rice has said, no, I don't want to be Secretary of State. Don't even ask. Which, you know, may well be a good thing. I was not all that enthusiastic about her, although I am concerned about John Kerry losing his Senate seat. But what if Joe Biden was made Secretary of State and Hillary Clinton was made Vice President? Okay. Anyhow, just a thought. One of those crazy thoughts. Charlie Crist So the former Republican governor of Florida, who has now become a Democrat officially, says that he officially regrets having signed a petition that says that marriage is a union of a man and a woman, basically an anti-gay petition or an anti-gay marriage petition. I think that's pretty cool. I you know, Charlie Crist is like, you know, waking up. Senator Jeff Merkley on our program, he said, you know, we should be lowering the Medicare age, not raising it. I think there's some good news going on out there. Meanwhile, you know, what's the old song? Everybody wants to be a star. I can't sing. Everybody wants to be a star is the refrain of the old song of that same name. And apparently that everybody includes wannabe comedian Steven Crowder, who's got a little viewed YouTube site from which he's trying to make a living. And it appears that in his rush to fame, Crowder punked Sean Hannity at that giant protest against Michigan's new right to work for less money law. Crowder apparently provoked a union member so badly the guy was knocked to the ground. When he came back up, he came up swinging. And in true Andrew Breitbart style, Crowder played the helpless victim. Hannity stepped right into it, referencing union thugs in his setup. This is, you know, just as before he brought Crowder on the air. And then he gave Crowder several minutes of airtime. Here's you have a piece of that? No, yeah, okay. And by the next day, this was day before yesterday, by yesterday, I think it became pretty obvious to everybody that Crowder had basically punked Hannity. That, you know, having provoked the union guy into taking a swing at him. So Hannity had him back on, along with another Fox contributor, a guy by the name of Andy Sullivan, so that Sullivan could set the record straight.
Smiles.
And here's that.
Well, listen, first off, that tape was very well edited. I happen to have seen some footage where it looked that he actually pushed a guy down to the ground, and that was the fellow that was actually striking him. And that's the way it looked to me. And if that was the case...
We just showed, I think, the tape that you're talking about where
you're missing a large segment that I saw in the room. And in the room,
I seen Steve's hands on that guy's back.
We have it.
I saw that guy's back go down, and then he came up off his feet. Yeah,
down.
There he is. What is that, Steve?
He did go down. He was attacking a tent with women and children.
Oh, he was attacking the tent.
Then
what were you doing?
We were there trying to prevent people from being quiet.
So anyhow, then yesterday, union member Tom Duckworth, who was there, told the story of how one of the guys who'd been a gatekeeper for the Koch brothers' Americans for Prosperity tent had himself actually helped bring the tent down.
While I was there, I observed a gentleman with an NRA jacket and a baseball cap with big NRA letters on it. Then later on, I think it was about an hour later, I walked around in the march around the Capitol, I took a shortcut back to the Capitol steps, which led me past the tent, one of the tents, and I saw that gentleman with the NRA cap again, and he was losing
the one who'd been inside the Americans for Prosperity tent all the previous time.
That is correct. Yeah. He was inside the tent earlier, and he was talking to the people that were inside the tent. And he was milling about the entrance. I think he was controlling who was going in and out. That was my impression. Anyway, later on, when I saw him again, he was undoing the straps to the site wall tent poles and kicking them in. And then subsequently, the big main tent poles, the tall ones, came down. But they came down from the inside. They basically fell straight down instead of... over, like it would top, like a tree would topple over. They basically just came straight down. Mm-hmm. So it looked like to me that they came down from the inside on purpose.
So here's what's going on. The Koch heads, have I coined a phrase? As in, you know, the people who take money from the Koch brothers, we should start calling them Koch heads, right? Anyhow, as the Koch heads provocation unravels, the people in Michigan are by and large in shock that their right to unionize has been blown up by Republican Governor Rick Snyder and his Koch-funded Republicans in the state legislature. And this is a big deal. And what's particularly interesting about this is that the American Legislative Exchange Council, ALEC, apparently was the source of this model legislation, this right to work for less legislation that got rammed through the Michigan State House and Senate by the Republicans, who are funded in part, you know, they're basically Kochheads. And then you've got this Kochhead governor I mean, the Koch brothers had laundered more than $900,000 through the Republican Governors Association to help get Rick Snyder elected. So you got a Kochhead governor, Kochhead legislators, and they passed this piece of legislation provided by ALEC, which is this group that of Kochheads, basically. It's this group that the Kochs fund, where every couple of months you get a bunch of corporate lobbyists and Republican state legislators together in the same room, and they write legislation. And then they take it, the Republicans take it back and introduce it into their state houses or senates. But apparently this bill was not written with the state of Michigan in mind. It was a little more generic than that. And in the state of Michigan, there's this commission that things like this have to go through, at least according to state law. So it may be, or the state constitution, it may well be that this law that was passed was unconstitutional. Now, in the meantime, there was this Emergency Manager Act, you know, the emergency manager law that allows Governor Snyder to appoint his cronies to take over cities and then sell their assets, like they did with this park in St. Joseph, Michigan. St. Joseph is a largely African-American town right next door, right across the river from a very affluent white neighborhood or community. And on the beach shore, on the shore of Lake Michigan, premium property. And there was a park that back in the 19-teens, there was this family that owned this big chunk of lakefront property. And by Lake Michigan, it's almost like oceanfront. I mean, it's just, you know, beautiful, beautiful property. And back 100 years ago, and their daughter died. And in the memory of their young daughter who had died, they gave this park, this property, to the city on the stipulation that it be a public park for all the children forever. With me so far? Now, back then, it was a white community. Then, over time, it becomes a largely African-American community. And then Governor Snyder comes in and says, this community is broke. We're going to take it over. We're going to bring in an emergency manager, they call them. I call them little dictators. And the little dictator of St. Joe said, hey, look at this. We got some land here that's right on the lakefront that's worth a pile of money. And there's a golf course that abuts it. And they would love to put another hole on the golf course. So let's sell that land to them. And thereby put some money in the coffers of the city, which the city can then use to pay the salary of the emergency manager. Nice work if you can get it, right? So that's what happened. So the people of the state of Michigan were so outraged by this that they actually passed in November in the election, they actually passed a ballot initiative that repealed the emergency manager law. It said no more little dictators from Rick Snyder. So what today did the Michigan House and Senate do? They passed a brand new emergency manager law. Slightly different from the last one, so they can say, okay, this isn't the law that just got repealed. This is the new improved version. This is, version 1.0.3 or 0.2. And Rick Snyder's talking about signing it so that he can keep his emergency man. You know, these guys, this is crony capitalism at its worst. This is oligarchy at its worst. Well, last night Bruce Bartlett said this is plutocracy, actually. You know where the Koch brothers are funding all this stuff and all these Koch heads are doing this stuff? It's amazing.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
At what point are the American people, and particularly the people of Michigan, going to wake up and say, no more Koch heads in the state house, in the state senator, in the governor's office? No more. Wants to be a star, and here's Mr. Obama saying that the Republican Party wants to destroy itself. I find this quite extraordinary. And Limbaugh saying President Obama is trying to get the Republican Party to destroy itself. Why else are they going to go along with raising taxes on the super rich? Somehow Limbaugh, whose last contract was for $400 million, doesn't realize that the average person who votes Republican doesn't make as much money as Limbaugh makes. I mean, you know, it's just, I don't know how to say it beyond that. It's, He says, if Obama succeeds and ends up getting a confession from Republicans, the tax cuts are the problem, tax cuts are the cause. What happens to the next Republican who campaigns on tax cuts? Not going to have a prayer. I don't think people are buying this stuff anymore. Limbaugh is still, you know, and all, so many of these guys in the Reich are trying to push this idea that the Cokeheads have been pushing for a long, long time, that taxes on the rich, on the Cokes, are taxes on everybody. They're not. And they don't want you to know that the time of greatest prosperity here in the United States, the 1950s, 60s, 70s, and arguably the first couple of years of the 80s, were all when the top tax rate was above 50% and when corporations were paying about a third of the cost of running our government. And now corporations are paying about a tenth of the cost of running our government, and the top tax rates on the very rich, on the Romney rich, is 15%. And that, you know, that's just, it's not a good thing for democracy. It's not a good thing for America. It's just not a good thing, period. John in Allen Park, Michigan. Hey, John, thanks for listening to WDTW. What's up?
I haven't really heard anybody mention another effect of right to work, and I'd like to give you an example of probably the best way to explain it. Let's say a teacher's union is negotiating a new contract with management, you know, like the school board or the state here in Michigan. Now that right to work is in effect, they think the offer is just beyond acceptable. So management says, take it or leave it. And if the teachers decide to strike, they just replace them with kids coming out of college.
Right. Yeah. No, it's that's what happens in a soft labor market. And that's one of the reasons why, you know, A, we need to engage in stimulative policies that tighten up the labor market. And we need to stop insane trade policies that are sending jobs offshore and overseas. And B, you're absolutely right. C, let me add to this, that when unions maintain a decent floor on wages, and you can argue that it's being done by keeping people out of the labor force because they're not members of the union, but that's a legitimate argument. But when that happens, what it does is it puts more money in people's pockets locally. They spend that money locally. That money circulates in the local economy, which stimulates the economy, which increases demand, which generates more jobs. Unions help generate jobs by making sure that people get a decent paycheck. The more we go toward, you know, Walmart and McDonald's type wages, the more that we have non-unionized, lousy paying jobs, the more you're going to see the economy collapse. So, John, I'm right with you. Excellent point. Thank you for calling and making it. Damien in Manorville, New York. Hey, Damien.
Hi, Tom. Listen, I have a couple of points. Can you please, you know, I'm like an independent. I used to call myself a conservative a lot, but I'll tell you this. I am pro-union. And it burns me, man, when jobs are going shipped overseas. It really does.
But I
will say this. You have to admit, you know, if there's no unions, then you're going to get management trying to trample on the workers. There's no question. However, what happens a lot of times, though, is that unions, they try to take advantage. And if you look at the hostess situation, from what I read, you know, it's like there's a lot of inefficiencies that management was trying to clean up. Like, okay, on the same truck, you can't have Twinkies and Ho-Hos together, even if you're going to go to the same stop. Like, that seems silly to me. Like, why, if I'm on one stop and they have cupcakes and Ho-Hos and yodels, whatever it is, they should all be on one truck so that they all get... But again,
Damien, what you're operating off are the talking points that have been put out by the hostess people. And I'm telling you, what took down hostess was bad management. Seriously, Damien, it was Bain Capital style. It wasn't even bad management. It was disaster capitalism. It was bankster capitalism. What happened was, I think it was about 5 years ago, they were bought by, and they're currently being run by banksters. The CEO right now is a bankster. He's not a banker. And the company has gone through these, you know, let's break it up, let's sell it off. The union's in the way. Well, let's do away with the union. Let's take the company through bankruptcy. Hostess is going to be fine. Ding-dongs and ho-hos and everything, they're going to be fine. They got over 100 companies that are bidding to buy the pieces of the company. But why did they want to break this company up and sell it off? Because some banksters wanted to make some money. That's the bottom line. I mean, you want to know what's going on with Hostess, look at Bain Capital, and look at how Bain Capital has deconstructed company after company after company, torn them apart, send the jobs overseas, or turn good union jobs into right-to-work-for-less-book jobs. And it's the Mitt Romney-style banksters that are driving this thing. And, you know, thank God that he's not running our country. Can you imagine a guy who's proud of the fact that, you know, his top tax rate is 15%, paid 14% last year, would have been 11%, but he played with his taxes, you know. I guarantee you, by the way, right now Mitt Romney is taking that deduction for the $1 million he gave to the Mormon church that he didn't take last year so that he could claim that he paid 14%. Because you can carry that forward if you're a rich guy. Now, you can't do that if you're the average Joe, but rich guys can do that. And so, you know, he's going to be filing an adjusted return. And just, you know, to think how close we got to a bankster running our country, to doing to us what they did to Hostess, to doing to us what they did to Sensata, it's incredible. It is just incredible when you think about it that the Republican Party had the audacity to run a bankster for president of the United States. A bankster worth, $500 million who pays a maximum income tax rate in a bad year of 10%. Really?
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
And then you get, you know, Limbaugh saying, well, now Republicans can't campaign on tax cuts. Oh, the sky is going to fall for cokeheads and rich guys like Limbaugh. Okay? Very, very meristiculously ugly, the good. Senator Jeff Merkley of Oregon, the Democrat. President Obama has been floating the idea of raising the Medicare age in order to make a deal with Republicans to avoid the fiscal cliff. Well, Senator Merkley isn't having it. Merkley told the Washington Post that the idea that we're going to take all these folks with diseases setting in as they get older and move them 2 years later, absolutely unacceptable. Merkley went on to say that we should be lowering the age, not raising it. Senator is absolutely right. Millions of senior citizens in this country rely on Medicare for access to life-saving health care. The fact that President Obama would even consider raising the Medicare age is simply unacceptable. And by the way, we're hearing from the senator from Illinois, Dick Durbin, that the White House is not considering raising the age of Medicare eligibility. The bad. Grover Norquist. Norquist was on C-SPAN's Washington Journal program this morning when he made a very odd and incredibly outlandish prediction. Check this out.
But we got lots of things Obama claims to be for, and the Republicans of the House and Senate, will make him actually make those spending restraints in order to get the continuing resolution out a week, 2 weeks, a month. Obama will be on a very short leash, fiscally speaking, over the next 4 years. He's not going to have any fun at all. He may decide to go blow up small countries he can't pronounce because it won't be any fun to be here because he won't be able to spend the kind of cash he was hoping to.
Right. First, there's nothing fun about being president when your nation's economy has been put into shambles by 30 years of Reaganomics, when Congress refuses to work together, and when you have two endless wars on your plate. And second, suggesting the president is just going to go around blowing up countries for the heck of it, that's just completely insane. And the very, very ugly McDonald's. Last week, workers of fast food restaurants in New York City walk off the job in protest of the incredibly low wages that they make. And now Bloomberg News has calculated just how low some of those wages are. In the case of McDonald's, according to Bloomberg data, an average McDonald's employee would have to work a whopping 1 million hours, 100 years, in order to make what ex-McDonald's CEO Jeff Skinner took in last year. Bottom line here is the CEOs are raking in millions of dollars every year while their employees aren't making anywhere near enough to survive or provide for their families. And that is very, very ugly. This is hysterical. First of all, I think that there's got to be a typo in this story, but maybe not. There is a state representative by the name of Lisa Lyons in the state of Michigan. And according to the article I'm reading in Raw Story, her middle name is Posthumous. Yeah, State Representative Lisa Posthumous Lyons. Believe it or not, I don't know. But anyhow, Lisa Lyons, she's a Republican. And she was supporting Rick Snyder and his whole, you know, let's pass this right to work for less money bill here in the state of Michigan, or there in the state of Michigan. But she offered an amendment. Her husband is a corrections officer. He works in a prison. And she offered an amendment that would have exempted her husband from the right to work for less provisions. It would have allowed corrections officers unions to continue to require all of their members to pay union dues so that the union can stick around. Her Republican colleague said, no, we're going to do cops. And, you know, that's like, you know, if you don't do cops, if you don't have the police on your side, you're in trouble. And we're going to do the firefighters because everybody likes firefighters. But corrections officers, not so much. People don't, you know, really have a fond spot in their heart for them, and correction officers aren't going to pull you over when you're speeding. So, no. So, poor Lisa Posthumous Lyons, state representative for the state of Michigan. Her husband now will join the ranks of the right to work for less crowd. Amazing. In Dillon, Montana, Carol is watching us on Free Speech TV. Hey, Carol, what's up?
Oh, I was just griping about them taking away the unions. That started with Reagan when Anaconda Company sold out to ARCO. ARCO said that the first time they went on strike that they would close the plant down and move it to South America. Well, they cut some of the benefits, the cost of living, and also the health care benefits of the people working for the company. Well, of course, they went on strike. They couldn't move it. They couldn't possibly do it. Well, they did it with Reagan's blessing.
Yeah.
And then we get Governor Roscoe, a Republican, moves in to the governor's mansion. First thing he does is he gets in contact with his buddy George Bush down in Texas. And then Enron's brought in on it. And then Goldman Sachs is brought in on it. And it's cost Montanans millions.
Wow. So this factory that closed...
I can't figure out why they vote Republican in Montana.
Yeah, I can't either. I think that some of them do because they're afraid of gay people, or they don't like black people, or they think for some reason that the Democrats want to take away their guns.
Oh, they've been watching too much...
Fox so-called news.
So what do I call them? Fanatical, oligarchist, xenophobes on TV.
Okay. Excellent one, Carol. Carol, thank you for the call. Thanks for watching Free Speech TV. Chris in Chesapeake, Virginia. Hey, Chris. What's going on?
Hi, Tom. I was just calling. One of the points that I wanted to make is that I would really love to be able to go to some of the yacht clubs and the country clubs of some of the wealthiest people in this country and be able to enjoy some of the benefits of that club membership without having to pay the dues. Yeah. I wonder what would happen if we all just did that.
I think you
wouldn't even have to take it that far. I mean, I have a membership to Sam's Wholesale Club. I would love to just show up there and be able to shop without paying the dues.
Yeah, you should have a right to shop.
Maybe they would understand the problem with this, the right to work.
Yeah, you should have a right to shop. You should have a right to eat a chocolate bar in a 7-Eleven and not pay for it. You should have a right to, but the association thing is the better point. Your analogy is actually better than mine. And spot on. That's a good one. And in fact, Sam's Club or Costco or whatever, great example. You know, hey, don't you have a right to buy things? Well, of course you have a right to buy things. Well, why do I have to pay dues to Sam's Club for it then? You know, excellent point, Chris. Thank you for calling and making it. Michael in Tacoma, Washington. Michael, you want to talk about
unions? Hey, how's it going, Tom?
Good. Good. What's up?
Can you hear me?
Yeah, I hear you just fine.
Okay. I'm a union member, and as you said, I live in Washington. But I'm moving to Texas, and I've gone to visit. And, you know, so Texas is a right-to-work state, and your question was, what should the union do going forward? Now, first of all, I've heard that all of the unions in the country are coming together to fight this evil that's being heaped on our shoulders now. And I think that's good. I think the next step, though, is a massive education program needs to be put on the entire country, because I believe that a lot of people just don't know what unions actually do for the working class in this country.
It's true. It's absolutely true.
I believe. Go ahead.
No, I'm just agreeing with you. I would guess that probably 90% of Americans, certainly 90% of American voters, don't know what unions do. I mean, 90% of Americans aren't represented by unions, so how would they know? We don't teach it in schools anymore.
Right. So I think that we should take that upon ourselves as unions to start to educate the country, because all of this misinformation out here is clouding the issue. You know, we've given everybody the 40-hour work week. I didn't work in a factory as a child, and I don't believe you or anyone else around our age did. You know, that those things have been gone away for quite some time, and there's much more history, and I don't have time to go into it on your show, but the education piece, so that individuals can truly understand what's at hand. I mean, in Washington State, the minimum wage is $10 an hour. Down in Texas, it's $7.25.
Right.
And, you know, while they try to sell that, the cost of living is different here. No, it's not. Meat, milk, and eggs cost pretty much the same when I went down for a little visit.
Yep.
Gas prices weren't any much less.
Yep.
You know, I mean, if I bought a home there, then I'd pay a little bit less. But the things that we need to subsist ourselves on a daily basis, there's not much price difference. And the other thing is, what it costs to put a building up out here, it pretty much costs the same down there. The only difference is the wages are lower, so the contractor is
richer,
having more money left in their pocket as opposed to the worker.
Yeah, this is where that big land developer down in Texas, I want to say Rick Perry, but that's the governor's name. But the guy who's been throwing around millions and tens of millions of dollars, you know, this is how these guys make their money. It was Bob Perry. Is by having that minimum wage at $7.25 and being, you know, frankly, if there was a federal minimum wage law, they'd be paying $5 an hour. And, you know, if they thought they could get away with it. And you're absolutely right. We lived in Oregon, which is like Washington. It has a higher state minimum wage than the federal minimum wage. And the consequence of that was, you know, is that you have a better standard of living. It's like the old saying from the Kennedy era, rising tide lifts all boats. And that's what happens with wages. Michael, thank you. You made a very good point. I appreciate the call. 45 minutes past the hour here on the Tom Hartman Program. We got to wake this country up, person by person, step by step. Do you have a right to shop at Sam's Club without paying?
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
I mean, it's amazing that this you have a right not to be represented by a union has been sold as some kind of a right to work. It's just amazing.
From the war against disorder, from the sirens night and day, from the fires of the homeless, from the ashes of the gay, democracy is coming to the
Yep, Sue Nethercutt, Sue in our chat room confirms it. Her Lisa's middle name is Posthumous. this is the state representative, the Republican state representative in Michigan, who proposed an amendment that her husband's job would be exempted from the new right to work for less money law. I got to start putting the word money in there, because that's what, you know, Obama said that a couple days ago, and he was so right. You know, this is not the right to work. It's the right to work for less money. The right to work for less money, yeah. Tom in Holyoke, Colorado. Hey, Tom, you are an IBEW member, just like one of my brothers.
Yes, I was an electrical lineman, and I was on a transmission line pole, and I cut out, fell, and was impaled on a steel fence post. Went in my back and out up through my shoulder.
Oh, my God.
Yeah, ouch.
Yeah.
And the IBEW really stepped up for me during that, and then, you know, when I tried to get a job that paid decent and had decent benefits, guess what? I had a pre-existing condition.
Oh, my.
Can you believe they wouldn't take me as an employee because the insurance wouldn't cover me?
Yeah, but the IBEW had...
The IBEW helped me. And now that I'm 60 years old and this the ribs were shattered, the fence posts went through so fast that it is so painful, I can't... It hurts to breathe sometimes. And they got me back into medical care and what I needed to live. And without that union, I would have been screwed.
Yeah. Well, good on the IBEW, Tom. And thanks for sharing that story. The IBEW is a great union. I gave a speech at, I keynoted the IBEW's conference up in Anchorage, Alaska back, oh, gee, it must be 4 years ago, 5 years ago, something like that. We did our show from there for a couple of days. In fact, we had brunch with Bernie. I was talking to Bernie Sanders. I was in the studio of our Anchorage affiliate, and which had an outdoor window that looked out on the parking lot, and then behind the parking lot was forest. And this moose comes walking through the parking lot. And I'm like, Bernie, there's a moose here in Anchorage. And Bernie's like, a moose on the loose. Yeah. That was, you know, one of those funny moments. Anyhow, Josie in China Grove, North Carolina. You have some information on people whose middle name is posthumous?
Well, it's a really ancient, of course, Roman tradition. Probably her father died before her birth. One of the children of Julia and Agrippa was born after his father was killed.
Uh-huh.
And he was named Posthumus. That was his first name.
Huh. And that would have been around, what, 50 B.C. or thereabouts?
Something. It was like before Tiberius.
Yeah.
Huh.
Amazing. So the question is, was she named Posthumus because her father died before she was born? Or was that her maiden name and that's actually a last name? You know, I don't know.
I doubt very much that that's a last name.
Yeah.
It'd be an awful name to have to tote around. But it probably is her middle name.
Huh. Yeah, well, that's what the news story says. It's Lisa Posthumus Lyons. So, yeah, very interesting. Well, thank you for that. I'm telling you,
you're welcome. Smartest
listeners on earth. Josie, thank you very much. Florencio, if I'm saying that right, in Hammond, Indiana?
Yep.
Hey,
you say
what's
it right.
So what's...
I'll say that same argument they got for union dues, couldn't they use this for paying state and local taxes or federal taxes? You can get the benefits of living in this community. Just don't have to pay taxes for the schools or the fire department.
You know, I don't agree with the guy who represents me all the time. I live in D.C., so nobody represents me. I suppose Eleanor Holmes Norton represents me in the House of Representatives, but she doesn't have a vote. So, but, you know, when I was in Oregon, for example, you know, we had Senator Smith, and I disagreed with Senator Smith a lot and very loudly on the radio, and he found that very obnoxious. Walked by me in a hall once, refused to talk to me or even look at me. And so I disagree with the guy representing me, so I don't want to pay my taxes. That's a great suggestion, Florencio. I mean,
yeah.
I mean, because the union, what did Abraham Lincoln call the United States of America? This union, right? If this union is to survive. So if the United States of America is a union and you want to apply the logic of the Republicans, you could say, well, I don't agree with the union. Well, actually, that's how the Republicans think. I mean, look at Romney. He's paying 15% income taxes on $20 million worth of income. And you know, if a doctor made $20 million, which is pretty unlikely, but, you know, if he did, if he was able to successfully do brain surgery on that many people, he'd have to pay 36% income tax. So I guess that, you know, that's really how the Republicans think. Florencio, thank you. That was brilliant. Rebecca in Everett, Washington. Hey, Rebecca, a minute to the end of the show. It's all yours.
Hi, Tom. I just wanted to call. You're so right about American people waking up here in America, because I watched the breakfast right after the election, the Republican breakfast,
mm-hmm.
and they stated right in that breakfast time, they stated that they were going to look to the states and try to work on different states because of the state legislatures were kind of turning radical, is what they said,
mm-hmm.
and they needed to work with those on districting and some of those other things. And they also talked about the fact that they actually restricted people from voting.
Right.
But
it's all about structural stuff now for the Republicans. They're going to try and make it harder for people to vote, and they're going to further gerrymander the states.
And well, I also studied Reaganomics when I was in college. I went to college late, and I studied Reaganomics. And it's been nothing but that ever since.
Yep, you're absolutely right. Rebecca, thank you for the call, and thank you for watching and listening to the program. Coming up tomorrow, it's Friday Brunch with Bernie. America's Senator Bernie Sanders will be here taking your questions in his national town hall meeting. And don't forget, democracy begins with you. Right? Share the good word. Spread it. You know, wake up, people. We have to help America wake up. Democracy is not a spectator sport. Tag, you're it. See you tomorrow.
You've been listening to Tom Hartman. For audio and video archives, go to TomHartman.com.